This is an RTRFM podcast. RTRFM is a community organisation and relies on volunteer and listener support. To learn more about what we do, visit rtrfm.com.au.
Toast.
Toast.
Right here. Right now. The most important thing in life will always be the
movie squad.
Salute me, familia.
Hello and welcome to another episode of Movie Squad Podcast of Movie Squad RTRFM, the official podcast which features me, Tristan Fidler.
And me, Simon Morado. Happy New Year, Tristan.
Happy New Year to you too.
what a wonderful year it's been so far.
2019, and we're getting things started off with an episode looking at, where we are now with Netflix streaming services as being a major arm of cinematic endeavor.
Absolutely. And over the holiday period, for sure, there are great movies in the cinema. People are probably going to see many movies over this break. But sometimes in the heat in Australia, you just want to chill at home with whatever streaming service you prefer. But for today's episode, we are joined by Janice Larec, our great friend and part of the Movie Squad bench, to talk about Netflix original movies and what that means, you know, what it means to be a Netflix original movie and what their content strategy seems to be when it comes to pumping out these strange disposable sort of rom-coms alongside auteur works that aren't being released in cinemas.
And truth be told, this episode was recorded earlier in 2018. So, yeah, we're talking about films up until that point. But we've missed out on a lot. Like, I've only recently caught up with what was the rom-com? See, I can't even remember.
I'll Set It Up.
Set It Up, which
we talk about at length on the show.
I enjoyed. Lucy Liu, amazing in it. What's the actor's name?
Glenn Powell and Zoe Deutsch.
I think he's doing a lot too much with his face in this one. But
otherwise, he's one of our great up and coming young actors.
Yeah.
Him and Noah Centineo, another Netflix original star.
So obviously, with this discussion, we might not be including or referencing things that you might be watching now. But that just means that we'll have to do a follow up where we get to weigh in on To All the Boys I've Loved Before and
The Ballad of Buster Scruggs and Roma.
Yeah, and I still think, as probably I said in this discussion, that we're going to see what happens when we finally get The Irishman, the Martin Scorsese long-awaited, very expensive film that Netflix is producing. But yeah, it's a very, very interesting topic, very kind of contentious area about, you know, what these streaming services do to our viewing habits, and something like Netflix, what are they producing? Are they just kind of serving us up the same old stuff, or are they, you know, giving us some like art house classics? Are they giving us some things that can contend with the with our favorites from years ago? So yeah, please enjoy and listen to this episode of Movie Squad.
Well, Netflix has been heralded over the past few years for releasing a stream of highly acclaimed Emmy award-winning TV shows, originating them and debuting them on their streaming service. But they've also been pumping out plenty of original movies as well. The question is, do they hold up to those TV series? Look, I'll spoil it now. They definitely don't. But I thought it'd be worthwhile having a chat today on the Movie Squad podcast about the Netflix original movies. There are in the hundreds. There are dozens upon dozens of them. There must be a few jewels lost in that bunch. Tristan, Janice, what are your feelings generally about original Netflix movies? Do you enjoy finding out, maybe being surprised when you log into Netflix on a Friday night and seeing, hey, there's a new movie starring Kelsey Grammer and Kristen Bell?
I'm interested if there's a new movie starring Kristen Bell and Kelsey Grammer. Okay, firstly, I need to say that whenever I engage with a streaming service, I am aware of that kind of existential crisis that I get into when I'm flicking through and I can't decide. So often I go in, like, not open to suggestions. I'm like, I know what I'm going to watch. I'm going to go in and find it. And I feel like that often means that I don't have those chance encounters, which can be really awesome with the streaming services. My experience with Netflix, I mean, usually I've heard of something that that is meant to be good or interesting at least, and that's how I generally access it. So a lot of the big ones that have kind of come out recently, like Meyerowitz Stories and Okja and Extinction and Annihilation and so on and so forth. So generally that's how I engage with Netflix as a rule.
You're not looking for a tile to be tempted by. You've got a mission in mind.
Oh, just because I go into that spiral, you know, like flick, flick, flick. Oh, it's midnight. Okay, time for bed. Didn't watch anything.
Yeah. Tristan, what about yourself?
Well, yeah, this very interesting point that Janice has made, that I think that often the Netflix originals are ones that, there's someone connected to it, usually a director that I'm on board with, like I've seen their work, or, you know, you mentioned the Meyerowitz Stories, which is one of my favorites, and that's mainly because I was like, oh, Noah Baumbach is like his latest film, and I remember I was so excited when it, I was just like, I had the day off and I was at home, and we were just kind of like browsing around Netflix, and I was like, oh, it's out, I'm just going to watch it now, and it was like an amazing feeling to go like, oh, it's I don't have to wait, it's just here, and that just being, you know, I really, you know, liked, I love that movie. I thought it was one of his best in recent years. But then, yeah, there is I think over the years, the brand has been weakened considerably, and there is a feeling that maybe the best ones are ones that are bought and like, you know, they've been made and they're taken in. And sometimes the best ones are ones that you feel like Netflix have given the green light to. But I think there are more misses than there are hits, and I have favorites, but then there are ones that I feel like, I was just looking at the list of originals, and one I remember watching and just feeling utterly disappointed by was Mascots, the Christopher Guest one, because I was just like, well, I mean, I think Christopher Guest in his career is in, you know, dwindling. Is a long way from his heights, but I remember watching this and thinking this is like not a movie, and it like ended in such a way that I was just like, this feels like I don't know, it just felt very, I think, you know, it's, there are some films under the Netflix banner that have that feeling of like, there is no budget for this, and what we're trading on is the names of the people involved. And so sometimes I'm more skeptical than not when it comes to the Netflix original.
Yeah, it seems that Netflix, you're talking about the movies that they seem to shepherd rather than the ones they just buy outright as if they're a distributor, they try and have, and who knows what it really is like behind closed doors, but they try and have a hands-off approach, which is, yeah, we are, you know, we're, they're not really flush with cash, but they have enough capital to give people money to do what they want to do. So if you're a filmmaker and you've got a vision, here's some money to go do your thing. Amazon did something similar with Woody Allen, and there are all these different examples. But because they're going, well, we're not creative types, we're just going to empower those guys to do what they want to do, what happens is the quality control is kind of off, you know? So you've got a guy like Christopher Guest who has kind of fallen from his greater heights and maybe needs some collaborators to help him create something new and equal to Waiting for Guffman or whatever. And he comes up with Mascots, which is basically 4 or 5 episodes of a pretty average Christopher Guest TV show stitched together. Like, it's not really a movie, even if it does have a few funny moments in it.
Yeah, you raise a really good point, Simon. What is the rationale here? It just feels like they're kind of grabbing films around the place at the moment a little bit. And I look through their catalogue and I'm kind of wondering, are they trying to create popular entertainment? Are they trying to foster great directors? Are they trying to make just fun, schlocky stuff? And I'm not sure. I feel like it's yet to be determined.
Hmm. You can look to so many film studios across different eras and go, well, that's the kind of movie they make, and that's the kind of movie they make. And this is not me saying we need to go back to the studio era of filmmaking. You know, we need to have, you know, directors who are on staff and all that kind of stuff. But you really don't know what Netflix's game is, and I think it's because they don't know.
Yeah.
And if they have a game, it's that they want to have content. They want to have constant streams of content.
Mm. Yeah.
Their goal is to eventually, because they know they're going to lose the Disney stuff when Disney sets up its own streaming service, and that'll mean losing Fox.
Mm.
And they want to have everything on Netflix be a Netflix property. And maybe that just means at the moment throwing money at the problem. You bring directors on board, you bring creatives on board, you pay Kenya Barris $100 million and you bring on Shonda Rhimes and just have these people creating stuff for you. and then we can figure out how to make it good or how to make it kind of ideologically consistent. I'm venturing off into the world of TV. I'm going to bring myself back because there have been some good movies, but I do. Let's talk about the bad ones first, because that's way more fun, and there's so many more of them. Has there been one that you thought, oh, wow, this is a filmmaker I like or actors that I like, and they're working on something, they've made a Netflix movie, and you've watched it, and it has been hot garbage? Like, I mean, Mascots, I have a little bit of fondness for, just because it is Christopher Guest, but it's not great. Janice, has there been something that you've watched recently that you thought, this does not live up to my hopes?
Well, yeah. I mean, I wish that I saw some hot garbage. I feel the problem with Netflix movies is that I'm sure that there are some really bad, hilariously bad films in there, but I haven't seen them. And the impression that I get mostly from it is just middling mediocrity. I mean, really, that's where most of it's at. So in terms of what's been really bad, I mean, I watched Set It Up, actually, the rom-com.
Oh, yes.
Yeah. And you know, a lot of... Yeah, rom-coms is one of those genres where whenever there's a rom-com that comes out, everyone's like, it's the return of the genre, the genre's returning, it's coming back. And it's never coming back the way that they want it to. You know, we're never going to have, well, you know, I don't think we're ever going to return to the 90s moment, for instance, not in the same way. And look, I mean, it was fine. It was, you know, they were attractive and the plot was serviceable. But I just, it didn't. It wasn't very funny and it wasn't very romantic and I didn't feel the chemistry. And so whilst it wasn't hot garbage, it was just kind of middling, I suppose. And I think that is kind of perhaps a characteristic of the kind of body of work that's on Netflix at the moment.
Yeah. It's so funny you say that because I almost agree entirely with you about Set It Up, and yet it's on my top 10 of Netflix originals because the bar is that low, right? Mm. And I do think Set It Up is a great example where people, like, it became a hit. It's hard to know what is a hit on Netflix because we don't know how many people are watching it, but it feels like everyone you talk to saw Set It Up. That was my experience, you know, because people discovered it on a Friday night or a Saturday night. And it's a benefit of Netflix that you can have a rom-com starring Zoe Deutsch, Glenn Powell, who I both really like, and I love them both in Everybody Wants Some, but also Lucy Liu and Taye Diggs. They're never going to be the four leads of a theatrically released rom-com, even a modestly budgeted one. But it was fun to watch them share the screen together, and the movie was super cheesy, but it knew what it was, and I was happy enough to watch it. But again, yeah, it is mediocre, and yet that's still some of the best things that Netflix has produced. On that note, I actually wanted to bring up a movie that is sub-mediocre, but in that same realm, Ibiza, which stars Gillian Jacobs, yeah. Phoebe Robinson, Vanessa Bayer. They're so great, the three of them.
Likeable, comedic presences, every one of them.
Absolutely. And I don't know if you've seen this one.
Do you mean Ibiza as in the island?
Ibiza.
The
island
Ibiza.
Destination. Yeah, the setting, you may know better as the setting of, I'm forgetting it now, but the classic early 2000s comedy, Kevin and Perry Go Large. Thank you very much. Sorry about that.
What a pull.
Yeah, it took a second.
Which I think it was a line of dialogue from the film. But yeah.
Exactly. But yeah, that movie is just about, hey, Gillian Jacobs, she has a tough boss. She needs her to go to Europe for a job. There's a big meeting and her girlfriends say, let's go to Ibiza overnight. And they just hang out. And it's literally a hangout movie, but in the worst sense of the term. Where, like, nothing happens. Literally nothing happens. Often it's not even trying to be funny. So I'm not really sure what that movie is or about. And yet I watched it all. And I chose that over Mudbound, a movie that received so many Oscar nominations, is a Netflix original, and I have still not seen it.
Mm.
I got sent the DVD screener around awards consideration time. Ooh. I have it on so many mediums to watch. And I've not watched Mudbound, but I have watched Ibiza.
Well, maybe that reveals what Netflix are going for, which is that they're going for the Friday night viewership, you know, just home from work, too tired to go out and party. I just want something easy. I don't want a worthy film about social issues or an aesthetically ambitious film. I want a rom-com or I want a hangout movie. So maybe they're succeeding in that regard.
Which is why I don't know anyone, even among critic friends, maybe one or two, that has seen Mudbound, because there was no screening for it. There was no impetus to go and watch it. But again, so many people have come up to me and said, have you seen Set It Up? Or I love Set It Up. That is their space, it seems.
And it is funny that they're I think it works with the fact that everyone can watch it at the same time, and that, you know, a film that got a lot of negative reviews, but everyone still watched it anyway because it was like the Christmas period, and this is like a film that's dropping, you know, before the weekend, which was Bright, the David Ayer kind of like, you know, his version, his re version of Training Day, but with like orcs. And this kind of world where like Lord of the Rings stuff is alive and well, but it's still gritty Los Angeles, and there are kind of like gangs and cops, and it's Will Smith and Joel Edgerton in unrecognizable orc makeup. And yeah, I remember going, hearing, you know, I think I was like, this is too much, where people were going on about how bad it was. Like, I was like, this is, you know, come on. But then it was also like, you know, I still watched it. And it was just like, this is pretty silly and very kind of, you know, beating you over the head with its kind of just bad. But there are these moments where I feel like these are the kind of the deciding moments of like Netflix. Like, you know, this is like a very expensive movie, and I think the next one will definitely be the Scorsese film The Irishman whenever it gets released. But the, you know, the amount of money that they're throwing at certain films, and then thinking like, what are they gonna get from them, and is this gonna last forever? And I don't think so. But yeah, Bright is a film that I thought was quite bad, but a lot of people watched.
You mentioned the terrible reviews for Bright, and I still haven't seen it. I was out of the country, thankfully, so I was free of Bright. But a movie like The Cloverfield Paradox, right, which by all accounts was not meant to be great or wasn't working, it had been delayed by Paramount for so long, and then Netflix secretly bought it and said, we're releasing it tonight.
Yeah.
It was I think it was the day of the Super Bowl. They said, after the Super Bowl, log on to Netflix, the movie's going to be there. So it got out ahead of the bad reviews, and it was also like, hey, there's a new Cloverfield movie.
Yeah.
Right? And the Cloverfield movies thus far have been pretty good. So that was a Tuesday night, and I watched The Cloverfield Paradox on a Tuesday night. I came home from work, and I was like, cool, let's see it. And it's so bad. And it's bad in all the ways you anticipate a movie that has been delayed for months and years. It was such a hodgepodge and wastes a great cast. But again, there's another element of the Netflix model, which is just like, okay, we'll buy your trash off you and can drop it in a way that it works for us.
Mm. And it's so interesting that they are making so many, or have so many, like genre films and like sci-fi films in particular. Mm. I feel like it's doing quite a disservice to what that genre is to put it on a small screen. I mean, perhaps we can talk a bit later about Annihilation, for instance, and how that didn't get a theatrical release here and how it was made to be shown on a big screen. And yeah, I mean, I haven't seen The Cloverfield Paradox. I heard that it was interesting in that the English-speaking cast spoke Mandarin in it or something.
Sometimes. I mean, okay. Like, that's given it way too much credit.
Oh, okay. Yeah. All right. Someone was looking for a redeeming feature. I mean, I am interested in this idea of its release strategy. Like, boom, surprise drop, look, a movie.
Yeah.
Versus maybe more advertising and publicity around films. I wonder if someone has a strategy for how they're going to release films on Netflix, because I imagine people do enjoy like finding a gem on Netflix. Mm. Maybe that's part of the appeal, or maybe not. Maybe they should be focused on advertising.
Yeah,
I don't know.
It's interesting. Sometimes I feel like it's Friday night and I know this movie's coming out or this TV show is dropping, Unbreakable Kimmy Schmidt or whatever it might be, and I have to find it. I have to go and search for it. Like, it's not being presented to me.
Yeah.
And that's kind of interesting. Maybe there is, like you said, there is appeal to going like, oh, this is my movie. I discovered Set It Up or whatever it might be, or Annihilation. There's also the other element, which is maybe it is very low risk for them to release terrible movies, because we don't, I mean, we're doing it literally here today, but, you know, we're kind of coming from a world of, you know, reviewing films and really, you know, looking into release strategies and all that kind of stuff. But the punter probably doesn't go, all Netflix movies are bad, because there's no real rhyme or reason to the type of movies they produce and release, and they are alongside all the other studios' films. So there may not even be an interpretation of a Netflix original movie. So it doesn't harm them to drop a terrible movie on Friday, because there's another 40 movies that were dropped alongside it, and there'll be 40 more next Friday as well.
And then the pool is dilated even further, because, you know, there's a list of Netflix original films that I'm looking at, but then depending on the territory, there are films that are acquired that are given like the Netflix banner on the thing, but they're actually not Netflix originals. Mm. Like, what did I watch recently? Sweet Virginia is like an acquisition, but it's not but it still says Netflix. Mm. Like it's, but yeah, it's funny that there's this like window of time where no one has seen the film and everyone's kind of watching it at the same time, and then like you can hear, you know, immediately when a film was bad. But like I was looking forward to it and thinking, oh, I hope, you know, after a few misses here that Duncan Jones might get back on track with Mute. Mm-hmm. And I'd heard all these bad reviews, but we still ended up watching it because I was just like, oh, let's just watch this film. And then that was like a film where it's the type of film that after you've watched it, you think of so many ways in which it could have been better. Like you like are rewriting the story in your head going, it would have been great if this is what they did. You know, like this is so easy. You just think, this would have been such a more interesting thing if this was the situation. And it was just like, and then there's also that, you know, you're talking about science fiction films, that kind of the budget feel of like, they just had like two locations here. The guy keeps coming back to them. And it just kind of, yeah, everything just feels a little bit, it just doesn't have that same, it just feels a little bit threadbare. They're trying their best to kind of make it look like a real movie, but there's still these patches where you think, yeah, I can see the seams a little bit.
We're going to talk about our favorite Netflix original movies. It's obviously a bit of a difficult task. You mentioned Annihilation. We all know that it's not really a Netflix original movie, and in fact in the US it's not considered because it was released theatrically there. Similarly, an Australian movie that was released theatrically here, Ali's Wedding, in America, that is a Netflix original. I really like that movie, but I didn't put that on my list, for instance. I do want to mention one more bad one before we talk about the good ones, because there are just so many. Death Note is pretty bad. I'll put that out there. I never liked Death Note. I never liked the anime. I never liked the Japanese films. And I really didn't like this version. But the one that really disappointed me, because here was an example of people I like getting money to make a film. They probably can't do it theatrically. Tristan already knows. They're not going to be able to put this up theatrically, so Netflix is the perfect home for it, and they can thrive and be weird and themselves. And it was the Workaholics guys when they made Game Over Man, which, again, is such a terrible film. I mean, obviously, No Die, it's a terrible film, but Netflix ruined Workaholics. Like, it ruined that trio or quartet and couldn't even empower them to make their movie, or perhaps empowered them too much in a way that they didn't have the creatives at Comedy Central who were helping shepherd that show. So that, again, maybe it's the poison chalice of Netflix is maybe a bit too much money and freedom sometimes.
Yeah, I mean, that's the utopian ideal, is that, you know, that Netflix is democratizing somehow and it's going to give, you know, going to give filmmakers an opportunity to be seen and have their movie seen. And I have heard, you know, my friend Grady in Melbourne has a theory that one reason why Australian cinema kind of picked up the past few years is because Australian films are being picked up on Netflix and more people are seeing them. For instance, The Babadook, being an example. And so, I mean, I don't have any data to back that up, but it's an interesting hunch and I wonder if it is the case. But yeah, then on the other hand, you have the situation where, okay, someone's been given a chance and it doesn't necessarily live up to expectations. I mean, maybe that would happen anyway if they were allowed to make a theatrical film. You know, sometimes films do disappoint. Yeah.
Very often, actually. Yeah.
Films disappoint. Yeah, I guess the question is, are they given an opportunity to disappoint more frequently through the Netflix platform? Yeah,
I think that's right. Shall we talk about some of the good ones? We've mentioned a few scattered throughout, obviously. Tristan, what are some of your faves?
Well, there's a couple I would put out there. I think one that for me, you know, you were talking a little bit about the discovered gem, and to me, this was a film that didn't really have a lot of kind of hype around it, but I enjoyed it nonetheless. Was the thriller Wheelman, which stars Frank Grillo. It looks exactly like Drive. It kind of a little bit is, but it's actually, you know, it's sort of a real-time thriller where this guy is a wheelman. He does a job, and then the camera is basically kind of with him for the next 90 minutes or so.
In the car.
Yeah, in the car.
It's like the first scene of Drive for an entire movie. Yeah.
So I quite enjoy that film. I like Frank Grillo a lot as a presence, and there's a lot of kind of favorites in there, like Garrett Dillon Hunt and so forth. And I like that film. Like, to me, it's not like a great movie, but I liked it, and I thought like it did, you know, it was satisfying in the way that I wanted to be satisfying. And then to me, like, you know, the great ones, I don't know, it's hard. Like, I love, you know, I know Zach Hilditch, so it's like, it feels a bit weird, but I thought that 1922, like if I didn't know him, I still would think it was like a great drama and a really good Stephen King novella adaptation. And I think like Gerald's Game, the other Stephen King adaptation, is quite good as well. Mm. And, you know, I think they're very interesting in that they're both a little bit, they're not very audience friendly. They're very kind of dark and challenging. And then sometimes it feels like, yeah, it is weird that kind of advertising thing. Like sometimes when they'll come out, it'll be a while before you see them kind of like advertised on that main screen. And then if you don't know about it, you like there's not really any avenues. Like they only barely send out people to talk about them. Like when they're involved, it is bizarre how they will acquire or spend money on original and then not really feel the need to kind of, you know, let people know about it in a very sustained or kind of, I don't know, strong way.
Well, it's very funny when there was a great report about how Netflix actually advertised their movies on their platforms and the tiles for each title, right? Mm. They actually alternate that based on who the user is. So the tiles that I'll see sometimes are very different to my wife's profile.
Yeah.
And then I'll look at these things and I'm like, oh, is that what you think of me, Netflix? Like, that's how you picture your movies to
me? I know, and they put them in such embarrassing categories, like films with a strong female lead. Yeah. Like, oh, don't reduce me to that, Netflix.
Well, and this is another bad Netflix movie I'm about to return to, A Futile and Stupid Gesture, which is David Wayne's sort of retelling of the National Lampoon story. And again, a great story, fantastic cast, and the tile for me was just Emmy Rossum, who was like 14th billed in that film.
Aww.
I'm like, come on, Netflix, I'm more complex than that, I'm more layered. But yeah, that's really interesting. Wheelman, I love Wheelman, and I prefer Gerald's Game to 1922, but both were kind of his fun little nasty novellas, effectively, right? Like movies, Stephen King adaptations you're not going to see in theaters.
Yeah, you can't imagine them, you know, you can't imagine seeing them at the Luna or something
exactly.
like that. Yeah. I mean, for me, it's kind of interesting because I think I probably have to say that the ones that I've enjoyed the most are ones that were acquired, I have to say. And I feel that I can speak about Annihilation as a Netflix original because certainly that's how Australians accessed it. Although, I mean, having said that, I mean, I just thought it was quite interesting in that, in terms of the casting and the way in which the story came together, and it was quite ambitious. And I think that it was quite widely viewed on Netflix. I remember when it came out, people really were interested in seeing it and accessing it that way. Mm. So perhaps that one. And I remember when Okja screened at Cannes, and like the Netflix banner went across the screen, and people booed, you know, and that film became so controversial and a centre of the kind of Netflix debate and its place in cinema. And it is a fantastic film, and in some ways I'm like, what are you doing on here? You know, I need to see you on the big screen because it's such a great romp and a family film in some ways, like a dark family film. So that's probably the ones, even though I know that they're sort of technically maybe not exactly Netflix originals.
No, that's totally fair. I will say, my feelings towards Okja are probably the most unpopular.
Mm. Not a fan?
I don't like it. I love Bong Joon-ho. I love The Host and Memories of Murder and all that great stuff. Okja for me was just like, nah. And it had the element of, you watch it on Netflix, you're not digging it, it's so much easier to kind of nod off and your eye kind of droops. So you have even less of a relationship to the movie when you're really not feeling it.
Mm.
But no, Annihilation's great. The one I wanted to mention is Win It All, which is probably my favourite of all the Netflix originals, is actually a Netflix original and is a Joe Swanberg film. And then he would also make the TV series Easy. Which is okay. You know, it's watchable. But Win It All, another collaboration with Jake Johnson, who plays this sort of gambler who really wants to get over his gambling habit, but then a sort of shifty friend has to leave town for a few days and leaves him with a bag of money.
Mm.
And it's just him wrestling with what he's going to do with that money and obviously how he's going to get it back, not to spoil anything. But that's such a Joe Swanberg movie. You know, that's a case where here's a guy who has never really had trouble, you know, like those mumblecore filmmakers, to get their movies off the ground because they're so cheap and they're so fast moving to make. And yet Netflix have given him the money and he's just used that to make Joe Swanberg movies. Yeah. And that's what I like about the ideal of the Netflix model,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So is that what's required? Is like, what's the formula for a great Netflix original? Does it have to be someone who doesn't require enormous budget, who does something that, you know, can be done within a certain framework, and, you know, is it finding the right person for the platform, do you think?
It might be. And Joe Swanberg might be one of those great cases. He has famous friends who can star in his small, quirky comedies or dramas. Mm-hmm. And he can make TV and movies. And they're easy to watch. And they're actually high quality.
Yeah.
He feels like the ideal for Netflix. But I also understand that there are going to be people who are like, well, no, I want to see something that is a bit frothier or something that has a bit more of a propulsive plot to it. And that's maybe when their aspirations grow a bit, you know, when their eyes are a bit bigger than their stomach, that's when the wheels start to fall off.
Mm. Do you think the Meyerowitz stories, was that, so at what point did Netflix enter into the production of that film? Does anyone know?
Well,
that's a good question, because Adam Sandler has a deal with Netflix, but it's not, that movie wasn't part of his four-picture deal or whatever it was at the time. Funnily enough, we were talking about Adam Sandler. He's made all these movies for Netflix in the last like 3 or 4 years.
Of course, like who didn't see that one coming? I feel like he's the person.
And so maybe that's, again, another version of the idea where he makes Adam Sandler movies, but by all reports, they're even worse than the ones he was making for cinemas. I've only seen Sandy Wexler, which I thought was okay. It was too long, and it wasn't great, but it was fine. But apparently the others are pretty god-awful.
It is interesting how, like, because he has this deal and they're all, you know, he just makes these movies that come under. But it's like he's also, like, been kind of removed from cinema. Like, it's just like, in one way, it's a win and a minus in that he is, like, you know, has this home to make more films. But it's also, like, it's...
He's out
also,
of the culture.
Yeah, it's kind of like he's also capped from, like, release cinema. And, yeah, I mean, I thought, you know, the Meyerowitz stories, yeah, I think that's one of my favorites, definitely. I love that. His performance in it is really great. And
he's the best of the lot.
Yeah.
The film, I think.
Yeah, and...
And Elizabeth Marvel, who's actually the unsung hero of that movie. She's so great.
It's a really, really, yeah, I thought it was a return for Baumbach to, you know, some of those earlier works, that kind of pain and awkwardness and uncomfortable, you know, nature of family, and very specific, but also kind of, you know, everyone I feel can tap into something from that, even though it's about very kind of specific, you know, a New Yorker family. And Annihilation, I loved it. It was interesting how, like, you know, everyone watches it, and I've got some friends who, you know, either had mixed results about it or didn't like it, and maybe there's a sense of it being like, oh, this is going to be like an Aliens type of movie, and it's a little bit is, but then, you know, what I you know, really liked about it was that kind of the visual style of it, the soundtrack, this is the kind of strangeness, and I much preferred it over Ex Machina in terms of the Alec...
Oh, really?
Alex Garland kind of... I don't know, I felt there was just more something satisfying, whereas at the end of Ex Machina, I just felt it was kind of a little bit closed off, whereas this, I felt like there was more kind of promised in a way. And, I thought Annihilation was great. I also want to... Because I was looking at the features and kind of feel like I'm cutting off another category of film, which is the documentaries. And there's two I'd want to recommend. One, in a way that I found it very compelling viewing, but I wouldn't necessarily... I think the director believes what he is filming, but I think you can watch it with a sense of detachment, and that is the Tony Robbins documentary, I Am Not a Guru. And it's, for me, I thought it was just fascinating because... It just takes you into this world of watching him, you know, do his thing as a motivational speaker for people who are paying thousands of dollars to spend this weekend with this, you know, gargantuan guy. And it's directed by Joe Bellinger, who's, you know, he's made other documentaries, Paradise Lost documentaries, and the Metallica documentary as well. I think it's in line with that Metallica one, where I think that he, as a director, sincerely, you know, believes in the benefits of Tony Robbins' kind of, you know, maxims and his stimulations or whatever of people to positive thinking or whatever.
But can watch it as a comedy.
Yeah, I was just watching it detached, just thinking about like the amount of money being spent by people wanting something from this guy. And the similar documentary as well as Jim and Andy, the making of
course,
A Man on the Moon with Jim Carrey. That was a documentary that was acquired by Netflix and is considered a Netflix original. And that's another film where I think the directors and some other people would think, oh, what an insight into the process of Jim Carrey. Whereas to me, I was looking at it objectively as going, no, this is like a insight into like
Jim Carrey just kind of like going, yep, I have free reign to act as an asshole because they didn't go with me right away. They were like thinking about me and Edward Norton, so I'm going to punish Milos Forman for choosing me eventually and bringing him down to my level. Like it's, quite something, I think, as a film.
So what kind of documentaries Netflix kind of have in their catalogue? Are these kind of like observational documentaries, I imagine?
I think it's the same kind of thing with the movies. They just do anything and everything. I mean, probably the most famous and acclaimed one is Ava DuVernay's The 13th.
Oh, yes, I have seen that.
Basically an essay, and it's a really it's a great documentary, and it's a really interesting argument, an essay film. Mm-hmm. But that is that's a prestige documentary, you know, whereas those kind of weirder ones that you're mentioning, like Jim and Andy, is so great because it's just like, it's like a special feature on a DVD gone wrong, you know, like but crafted so well. I think that's what's special about that, and like, and you wouldn't normally see that kind of thing in theaters. Whereas something like The 13th is very much of the kind of documentaries that will get eventually released in a cinema.
Another one I'm just reminded. I'm looking at the list. You know, the other films that I've seen, like Virunga, the one about poaching in Africa, produced by Leonardo DiCaprio. But the documentary about Tig Notaro. I remember being very moved by that.
That is good. Yeah.
Team Foxcatcher, which I haven't watched.
That's not very good. The movie is better, believe it or not.
And they
did Icarus, which won the Oscar this year for Best Documentary. I haven't actually seen that, but that's about the Russian doping.
I'm just remembering some of the ones that I've watched. Into the Inferno, which I kind of enjoyed, but also like fell asleep through, which is the Werner Herzog documentary about volcanoes and kind of,
On Netflix?
Yeah, wow. Into the Inferno.
Excellent.
That's the thing, how the memory kind of works. Like there's the first wave of like Netflix originals, and then it just kind of like comes polluted by all these ones that come after at a greater rate as well.
And maybe we should actually end on the note of giving them a bit of credit, because you mentioned Werner Herzog. He is such a prolific filmmaker that they basically, in Australia certainly, have stopped releasing all his films theatrically. Mm. And sometimes you might see them if you're like flipping around on iTunes, for instance, and you're like, oh, that came out. That actually is available and I can rent it for $6 now. Netflix are willing to pick up those weird little movies that maybe won't get picked up elsewhere. So we can still see the Werner Herzog documentaries, because I think the last one that got a theatrical release was maybe Encounters at the Edge of the World.
The one about the cave.
Cave of Forgotten Dreams. No, I think Encounters was after that. Either way, it's been about 6 or 7 years.
Yeah.
But at the very least, we know that, well, Netflix is still paying attention.
Well, I will say there are, hopefully this won't date us, but there are a few that I'm looking out to see. For example, one that I think I've heard is finished filming is Dolmite Is My Name, which is a biopic about a Dolmite, the comedian, actor, early rapper of blaxploitation, played by Eddie Murphy, in a script written by the writers who've done things like Ed Wood and The People versus Larry Flint. So hopefully that could be good.
Right.
What else? There were a few titles that took my eye, like A Christmas Prince, The Royal Wedding.
Oh, that's a sequel to the A Royal Wedding.
Yeah,
which was another one of those movies that everyone saw.
And I guess there's another film, A Catfishing with a Happy Ending. That could be good, something. Carmen San Diego. Look, I think it'll be whenever we get to the point where The Irishman comes out, I think that will be the next step. And the reaction to that will determine maybe the spending future anyway of Netflix.
The next stage of evolution. I mean, I'm definitely interested to see what happens with this new Disney streaming platform. I think that's going to force a big change in the field.
And then we'll have to talk about original Disney streaming properties like the Lady and the Tramp remake, which is going to be one of their...
Oh, really?
That's not theatrically released. They're making that for the streaming service. So, again, we'll be comparing Disney theatrical with Disney streaming. And I think you'll probably be able to delineate even better there what the quality difference is. But, look, we may be losing the theatrical experience, but at least we still have movies like Set It Up and Bright to enjoy.
Absolutely.
So there we have it. Thank you for listening to this episode, this summer edition of Summer for Australia, edition of Movie Squad, where, we have incorporated previously recorded content into this stream, but...
we deserve a holiday. We don't have to be in the studio in early January. Of course we didn't record this in the new year.
No.
But nonetheless, we will be back very soon with some brand new conversations. Plenty of cool stuff to come this year. Mm. But thanks again to Janice Larek for joining us and to you for listening to us throughout 2018 and into the new year. Why not show your reciprocate that with a nice review on iTunes and telling your friends to subscribe to the Movie Squad podcast.
And also like us on Facebook, Movie Squad. I think there's a few Movie Squads out there, but we're the best. So
yes.
Please see us. We've got the great Stage Left design logo and, as you can hear, this great music by Eddie Electric. Thank you for listening once again. We'll catch you next time on the Movie Squad podcast.
Thank you for listening to this RTRFM podcast. RTRFM is a community organisation and relies on volunteer and listener support. Visit rtrfm.com.au for more podcasts and other great content, as well as details on how you can support the station. You can also download our app and access RTRFM anytime and anywhere on your mobile device.